Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, the first day. Oftentimes the toughest day, huh? Except for the second day. You don't know, do you? It's unsure. But just to encourage you to try to trust in this very simple awakening. Rather than try to fix anything or become anything, trust in that. It's a very honest thing, isn't it? It takes a lot of honesty just to awaken to this moment. It takes a lot of patience. And this is the way I've been taught by Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah and other teachers. So that the monastic life that I've lived by, by no means was it very terribly interesting. You'd think, well, you lived with a great teacher, it must have been really interesting. Yeah, I didn't see him that much. Sent me off to branch monasteries, or I was in my kuti. But certainly he's a very powerful teacher, wonderful teacher. And just being with him for a short period of time would energize me for months. So there's certainly that. And I probably wouldn't have been a lifer, it hadn't been for Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho, so I have tremendous gratitude to them. Each year in Thailand, there's a great gathering of Ajahn Chah's disciples at his monastery, and it marks the memorial day of his dying. And this year was the 21st year since he's died. And the gathering is a 5-day gathering at Wat Nong Pa Pong in northeast Thailand, his monastery. And it's usually a five-day gathering of meditations and reflections and training of monks and offering of dana and chanting. It's very, very beautiful, beautiful, beautiful time. And the final day is a day where we do a circumambulation around the stupa. And this year, that's on the 16th of January, this year there were 900 monks and 6,000 lay people. Very silent, very reflective. And it's become actually the biggest celebration in northeast Thailand now. Interesting. It's the biggest gathering in northeast Thailand. And it's also a kind of... The way Ajahn Chah's monastery is set up is there's an inner wall and an outer wall. And between those two, like between the inner wall and outer wall, it's quite active there. And so during these 5 days, different branch monasteries set up kitchens, and then these kitchens offer food to the laity for free. And now I've heard, you know, people from the area come and take bags of food home, which is unfortunate, but... Anyway, Thais are very generous, very, very generous people. But then in the inner part of the monastery, it's much more contemplative and reflective. And so the grounds are filled with little tents, lay people, and the monks are usually in the back. They have their mosquito nets, and all the kutis are full. And so there's this great gathering of faith and devotion. It's really something that, you know, we don't get too much in Ontario of that. So you have a sense of a culture which, Thai culture obviously, I mean, has a lot of problems, so we could talk about the negative aspects, but a culture which honors a teacher, reveres a teacher so highly and supports practice and publication, that's quite it's a powerful reflection on the types of energies a society can manifest. And in Ajahn Chah's day, the villages that he was a part of, they're very isolated from each other. There's a lot of forest, and they were subsistence agriculture. And the most trusted and revered people in that culture were the forest monks, especially the accomplished forest monks. And if a monk like that came through the village, they were really honored. They would teach, and then they'd wander off and sometimes live at the edge of the village and sometimes start a monastery. And Ajahn Chah did that. And one of the images which I kind of bring to mind is that in Ajahn Chah's culture at his time, when he was a boy, and I've said this before, you've probably heard it, that the kind of, like in our culture, Wayne Gretzky would be or who was the guy now? What's his name? Guy that plays for Pittsburgh? Yeah, okay, so that might be a kid's, you know, well, if I was like that. Well, in Ajahn Chah's time, it would have been someone like Ajahn Mun, a great forest monk. So the Wayne Gretzky image of a kid, of a boy, would be an arahant. You know, it's so different, isn't it? Rather than a rap star. It's a different kind of rap, I guess. So, I don't know if you've read, some of you might have read the biography of Ajahn Chah. When he was a boy, you know, kids play games. He was playing Ajahn. So that other kids would come and offer him bits of stone or whatever, and he'd sit there. So he had a vocation. So anyway, so going to Thailand, it's like, it's a monk's paradise, really. Get off the plane and go into customs, as soon as any official sees a monk, off to the VIP section. Zip through. So they have a great respect for monks. And so Thailand has many, many, many problems. It's a very complex culture. But this aspect of it is very inspiring. So when I go to Thailand, I kind of float around in an Ajahn Chah bubble. I don't mind at all. Thing is, about a culture like that, people can take it for granted. So that it can be so much all around. So sometimes Ajahn Chah would say, you know, to his villagers, he'd say, yeah, you're like an ant crawling on a mango. You just crawl over the mango, you never taste it. So we are, you know, we don't come, most of us don't come from faith cultures. Probably we're more cynical, more skeptical, probably. We question a lot. But I think within that question is tremendous sincerity. There's a real yearning for understanding, a real yearning for peace. And to do this kind of a retreat, most Thai people have never done this. Most Thai people don't meditate. And you think, oh yeah, if you're a Buddhist, you meditate. That's for monks. Monks do that. So I have a friend who he tried out for the Canadian Olympic rowing eights. He's a strong person. And he said, this is much more difficult than trying out for the Olympic team. And I went, really? That made me feel pretty good. But there is a particular difficulty in facing one's consciousness, you know, the things of the mind, facing up to and taking away all the distractions, because we live in such a, in many ways, very interesting society with all its interesting distractions. You know, what you can, whatever you're interested in, Mr. Google will tell you. And so there's a great possibility of being fascinated, interested, and it's not immoral. But the trouble is, of course, as long as our attention is out all the time, it's out on the rim of the wheel, and interest itself then becomes exhausting. And now we, you know, on a retreat, we take away all the distractions, and we put on a pretty rigorous schedule. Close down the avenues of speech, see what happens. And what happens is, well, there's no escape. And what happens is whatever the mind brings up. How could it not be difficult when there's such a profound change, such a your usual, just where you sleep and the things you eat and what your routines, all that's kind of been taken away. So there's a kind of major upset, maybe, I don't know. Maybe not, maybe it's just, oh great, I don't have to do all that rubbish. Probably a mixture of both, a bit of both. For me, it's pretty easy. I just sort of just recreate the monastery. Because this is really, we're not in retreat mode all the time, but it's sort of easier for me. But just to encourage you to see, like, the difficulties that do come up, just like boredom or painful hip or I'm not getting anywhere, those kinds of mind states, tiredness, bear with that, because what we're developing the capacity to be peaceful with all conditions, and that's what we mean by non-grasping. Non-grasping is a powerful idea that we contemplate a lot in Buddhism, and non-grasping is the capacity to know things just as they are, and learn how to be at peace with them. So we talk about the peace of non-grasping, and the peace of circumstance, circumstantial peace, or circumstantial kind of well-being comes about when your circumstances are such. So when you have, you have your own comfort zones and your own diet and all the things that you like, you have it all set up, then you can achieve a certain amount of comfort, a certain amount of peace. And we all do that. You know, we have aesthetic tastes, we have friendships, we have certain dietary preferences and so on and so forth. But we all know that that's just circumstantial. And when the circumstances change, in a way that is out of our control, and much of it's out of our control, then of course the more we are beholden to those circumstances, the more we are dependent on those circumstances, the more we suffer. Whereas non-grasping is not dependent on any condition. Non-grasping is not asking that the world be any different than it is. And that's a freedom which is what we say transcendent freedom, not conditioned. This takes a bit of work. This is different kind of work. It takes work to set up a household too. It takes work to pay your mortgage and take care of your kids and get food on the table, and that's good work too. And to establish a good lifestyle so that one can deepen one's understanding of Dhamma, that's important. And that's the good fortune that we all have. Somehow we've managed our worldly affairs sufficiently that we can be here and practice together. So that's to be praised. But I think we see the limitations of that. I think we all see that. And we hunger for something. We yearn for a deeper kind of peace or deeper kind of insight, and so we undertake these kinds of practices. So non-grasping is become points to the same kind of thing, that when we know conditions just as they are, as changing, we begin to abide as awareness itself. And although the condition might be upsetting or difficult or whatever, we realize, well, peace is not just about having conditions the way I want them to be. Peace is about being accepting all conditions as they are. So on a retreat, remember that it's all part of the retreat. If you think that bit that you don't like isn't part of the retreat, that's wrong view. Like contemplate, what's the probability that today and for the rest of the retreat, everything will be to your liking? What's the probability? Right? So if something arises which is not to your liking, is that anyone's fault? Or is that just in the nature of things? Huh? Is that just in the nature of things? What's the probability that everything that's going to happen is going to be to your liking? Zero? Right? So when something comes up that's not to your liking, obviously if it's difficult, one can make requests or so on, but just in the nature of human interactions or your own body or the diet here or whatever I say or the schedule, I'm sure you could think a better way to do it. I'm sure you could all think of a better schedule, especially when your knees are hurting, right? Or a better way to say something or whatever. But what we do in a retreat situation is it's a kind of, we give up to this social structure, we give up to this routine, and then rather than kind of rearrange things, we try to observe the way things are, our liking and disliking. We try to find that in the heart, which is okay with liking and disliking. And that's where we find the peace of, which isn't circumstantial, which isn't dependent, not dependent on circumstances. So to have enough mindfulness to say, you know, I don't really like this, and witness it. Like if you're in the retreat and 3 days go, you know, it's day three, you're not getting anywhere, right? And your mind says, enough, I'm out of here. You can go. I'll give you permission. I won't even give you a hard time. But would not be better if you have that mindset, oh, this is what it feels like to be absolutely fed up. Ajahn Sumedho has a good line. He says, when he was in first year, he says, and then I'd think, I can't take this for another second. Oh, there's 2 seconds. But you can see how if a mindset comes up like that, assuming there isn't some kind of illness or some kind of real difficulty, but just like you just be so fed up with it. Why am I doing this? Oh, this is what it feels like to be fed up and thinking, why am I doing this? It's a tremendously strong thing to do. You can see how now that kind of mindfulness would lead you to transcendence, would lay the foundation for is non-grasping. And it's a kind of freedom then which is more profound than liking what's going on or enjoying what's going on or even thinking you're accomplishing something. That sounds pretty dour, doesn't it? But I'm just pointing to the fact that the like inspiration and liking the Dharma and being inspired and, you know, rah, 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 that's all very well and good, but how often do you get there? Sometimes you feel inspired, but oftentimes it's really ho-hum. Another day in the monastery. And yet, being with that, and just like Ajahn Chah would say, if you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. Was really helpful teaching. Just day in and day out. Because it is impossible to keep the mind inspired all the time. It's just not, it's not Dharma. It's not Dharma. So if one thinks that meditation is like being inspired, having like really, really neat, open-hearted, chakra opening experiences with a universal God or something like that, or whatever, then you're in for trouble. But if meditation is just, this is the way it is now, very ordinary, just very ordinary, then it's all part of the practice. So everything, as Ajahn Sumedho says, everything belongs. The things you like about the retreat, the things you dislike about the retreat, the things that inspire you, the things that annoy you. The things that annoy you, how long do they annoy you? You know, the initial impression of annoyance is just that, right? And the question to the contemplative is, how long does that reverberate in the mind? If it reverberates in the mind all afternoon, what's that about? That's certainly not letting go, is it? Right? Now, if it reverberates in the mind and the mind projects outwards, then what's that about? And that happens on a retreat. You know, it does happen. You just, for some reason, you get annoyed about something, about someone or the diet or something. But remember, it's not like a retreat isn't a kind of gourmet experience. or that's not it. So the basis of monastic life, which I can share with you, are kind of several principles. Two are the social principle, sila and dana, and that is a morality and generosity. And morality is, it's, think about morality. Morality is you pay attention to an idea. You uphold an idea, and when other competing ideas come into consciousness, that idea has power. So like if I'm trying to develop right speech, and I see maybe my speech is somehow socially destructive, that I hurt people with wrong speech or something like that, or gossip in a way which is unkind, and I don't like that. I don't like that result, the remorse in my mind. I don't like the social result. Then what do I do to train with morality? I bring up the idea, I'm not going to say anything to hurt people. I'm not going to think ideas to hurt people. I make that idea really, I pay attention to that kind of idea. And then the competing energies are, wanting to rip someone down or put them down or just being really critical and judgmental of them and so on. And saying, oh, that's the competing idea. But I hold to this other idea, this moral idea that I want to train with. So it's a reflection, it's a training. And that's beautiful because it kind of creates a kind of conversation with your life, a conversation with your moral aspiration. And that's the foundation for mindfulness, isn't the foundation? I've shared with you probably this lovely memory. I was must have been about 10, 11 years old, and I can remember the store. And my parents had sent me off to buy something from the store. I don't know how old I was. I was a little kid. And the guy and I was paying for it, and the guy in front of me was paying for something. He dropped $20 on the floor. Now, I mean, this was 66, so it was like 50 plus years ago. $20? And he's like, how much would that be today? So here I am. Here's this little kid. I probably had some sweets or something. $20 on the floor. No one knows it's on the floor. $20, and it was. It's one of the strongest memories I have of my childhood. This battle, this moral battle. You know how much ice cream is in that? Do you realize? And this incredible struggle went on. And fortunately, I picked it up and gave it to the storekeeper. He gave me $1 reward. And it's one of those beautiful memories. One of those beautiful memories. And that's because my parents really had very, very strong moral values. You know, very, very strong moral values. And that even as a kid, that that idea then was what was having a conversation with the $20. And the other competing force is ice cream. Or whatever I was thinking. Maybe it was potato chips. I don't know. And so that's how we train in morality, don't we? So, and then generosity. So immorality is the kind of restraint part of the things that we undertake, like not harming sentient beings and being loyal to each other with our speech and so on. And generosity is the expressive part, the way we look out for each other and so on. So that's one of the foundations of a spiritual life. I think you all are parts of sanghas now, right? So I kind of would ask you, well, what does sangha mean? If you're a part of a sangha, what commitment does it mean? Is it a commitment? Does the word have any power? I know for me, for bhikkhu sangha, it's a huge commitment. I've got a lot of restrictions and restraints. So what would sangha mean to you? Does it have, like, is there can one do what one wants and still be part of a sangha? Is there any kind of, like, when you call yourself like a TBC sangha or a Satipanya sangha, when you sign up for sangha, is it like their agreement? I don't know. I know for me there is. So the kind of the moral restraint that is the foundation for this teaching and for this lifestyle is a very, very important part of being sangha. So morality and generosity are one of the foundations. Another is Satisampajanya or Satipanya. I've heard that Spring Rains has changed its name now to Satipanya. Actually, I really like Spring Rains. But Satipanya is beautiful too, because that's the axis. When I talk about the center or that which includes both of those ideas, that's Satisampajanya, or mindfulness and clear comprehension. Because when I can really know this moment, this is the way it is, that's Satisampajanya. And that's one of the bases of a spiritual life, or of a monastic life, or of a life of sangha, I would say. When you're meditating and you know your mind gets caught up with some kind of thinking about planning or future, and then maybe you hear someone cough really loudly, and all of a sudden you're there. That's Satisampajanya. You really know the moment you're there again. That's Satisampajanya. That's the center. And that's what we're trying to reinforce, make strong, keep going. So that's the second basis of a spiritual life, I'd say. The third is restraint, indriya sangwara, sense restraint, and that's also included in the eight precepts. So in those eight precepts, I just brushed over them yesterday because it was getting late and I thought you're all pretty tired from hearing talk and all that. But anyway, the third precept, the brahmacharya precept, not participate in any sexual activity, that's a renunciant precept. It's not a moral precept. And so that's simply simplifying life and observing sexual impulses through a celibate lifestyle. In marriage or in partnership, then sexuality is to be understood in fidelity, in relationship. It has to be understood either way, because it's a powerful energy. We need to understand it. How is it appropriate in different social contexts? So this social context is more monastic, so it's celibate. But celibacy isn't a statement against sexuality. So it's a part of sense restraint or simplification. The precept on entertainment and adornment is a renunciant precept, and that's also a part of simplification. So and sense restraint, so we don't have our usual media that we might participate with. There's nothing wrong with that. They're not immoral. But you can see that when you don't have those avenues of activity, it is a way of calming the mind. It's very, very helpful, sense restraint. So sense restraint is very important, very important. You know, like if you're going downtown and you start to get like confused and you just focus on walking, you know, all your energy comes down and you're walking, you can compose yourself. Or if you're looking around a lot, which is okay, but if you're getting confused, that's what I do. I mean, like, I went to the ROM, and we went to the ROM yesterday morning or something. It was great. It was a real anthropologist, because I don't get out much. You know, I had just been in a monastery doing retreats, so it was very interesting anthropologically that way. But if I start to, if my sense doors get too bombarded, then what do? I just collect. I just come to the heart. I don't look. I compose, and I just walk, and I just collect. I collect the attention. That's sense restraint. We collect the mind. We can do that. And that's part of retreat, and part of Sangha life, I think. You know, the kind of, and we all do that, don't we? You know, we all find ways of being in this complex society and quietening everything down. I think it's a natural inclination for anyone who is into meditation. As much as possible. Sense restraint, that's Indriya Samvara. And santuti. Santuti is contentment with little. Santuti is kind of based in monastic life on the four requisites, on alms food, robes, medicine, and a simple lodging, the kind of basics. But what it's pointing to is really, you know, how much does one need? And to kind of to simplify life and to try to actually bring up contentment as a contemplation. So the way the monastics are the way we're trained is that food is offered to us, and then we certainly have preferences, you know, that's natural, but that's not the way we're training. We're not training in being connoisseurs of broccoli or, you know, wanting different types of muesli or whatever's on the buffet table, that's what's offered. So the mind has preferences, but that's not what we're training in. We're training in, thank you, because we're alms mendicants. We don't go shopping and so on. So then the reflection is, this is good enough for the day, good enough to survive for the day, and then gratitude for the offerings. Now that kind of training, you know, do it for a long, long, long time, and it's really peaceful. It's really peaceful. Where the other, the kind of train, kind of like having a lot of choices in diet, might be more healthy. I'm not sure, but it's not that peaceful, because then when all those preferences aren't there, the mind might you know feel it's lacking something, the body or whatever. So the contentment with little is very, very helpful. So these are the basis of Sangha life, the way I know it, monastic Sangha life. So there's also Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship. There are many, many factors. But say on this retreat, just take that, like contentment with little. Take that as a training. It's a very lovely training. So when, like, whatever food we were offered. I know you've had to pay money, so you have certain expectations. I didn't have to pay. So it's a different ball game. But as a kind of contemplation, you see the food there and you see what your mind does. It's wow. Or you know, whatever. Like, but yeah, but it's good enough. It'll get you through the day. It's fine. Yeah. And so that kind of contemplation then leads to peace, content with little. But that's not saying you can't have preferences. Sure, that's fine. But you begin to awaken. Oh, this is the mind which prefers, and you choose. If it's there, you choose. Obviously, you like tea or coffee or juice or milk or whatever. That's fine. But just this kind of simple reflection, contentment with little, it's good enough. And then bring that into your meditation. Your meditation, like one day it's really kind of okay, and next day it doesn't feel like. It feels terrible, then it's good enough. I didn't run away. Good enough, just good enough. That's very, very peaceful. But it's not an ideological position. All Buddhists are content with little. That's dogma, isn't it? But rather, it's a reflection. And this is the way that Sangha life is a training life. This is what Sangha life is about. It's a kind of, it's a training, an undertaking, where you're training the mind in all these very skillful ways that the Buddha offered us. Now, it's just like morality. You take an idea and you uphold it, or you concentrate it on you, or you pay attention to it, don't you? So you take an idea like contentment with little. You take that idea and you uphold it, and so you work with it. It's a contemplative idea, and this is what contemplation is. Dogma or idealism, attachment to idealism, is just the thought, I should be content with little. But that's just an ego judgment. So that when you're not content with little, you feel guilty, or you think the monk doesn't know what he's talking about, or whatever. But reflection is like taking an idea and then working with that, isn't it? That's what the contemplative life is about. So you take an idea like that, like content with a little, then you begin to watch discontent. Oh, discontent. Oh, yeah, it feels this way. So you begin to, your mind begins to have a conversation between contentment and discontent, rather than the ego conversations. Oh, I want it different. It shouldn't be this way. Why do they do it that way? Which is endless kind of suffering, isn't it? So the mind begins to have a kind of conversation through the Dharma, through the suggestions of the Buddha, rather than through our, you know, habitual likes and dislikes and ego mind. Even like with your own, the way you perceive yourself as being whatever. You know, most of us have a kind of, we can really hold to a negative perception of ourselves. So we'll take an idea, and that idea has been maybe unfortunately conditioned into us through various reasons. And we won't even realize that we're holding to a negative idea of ourselves. And it'll be the same thing. Then we're having a conversation with ourselves through a negative idea that I'm not adequate, or I'm not diligent enough, or, you know, I'm not strong enough, or I'm not trying hard enough, or I'm not beautiful enough, or that my body size is wrong, and it goes on and on and on like that. So I get that with like training monks. You know, I kind of think, when I get over fussy, then I keep thinking, I'm not doing enough for them, or I'm not trying hard enough. And that just comes from my own self-critical framework. And then, so you have to awaken to that. So there are ideas that we pick up and we uphold and we pay attention to, which are unskillful. And they're always involved with self. And so what we're trying to do in the part, you know, in the practice of Dhamma is to see, oh, this is just a thought. But is it a skillful thought? Is it an unskillful thought? This is an idea. This is a perception. So we're training and changing our perceptions, the way we perceive things, the way we interpret things. So it's very profound what we're doing. You know, it's not just the kind of, if we're serious about this, you know, if we really want to do it seriously, it's not just a kind of spa weekend. It's like a real, real commitment of the heart. But the thing about that is, if it is that deep commitment, then everything becomes meaningful, doesn't it? You know, everything, even the most difficult, the most negative situation, it has meaning. It's not just a bad joke. Otherwise, it is, isn't it? Why do this? So we bring meaning to things like negativity or discontent. And how do we bring meaning to it? We awaken to it. And these suggestions that the Buddha offers of contentment with little, sense restraint, santisampajanya, morality, generosity, these become ways that our whole interpretation of life is according to Dharma, is according to the Buddha Dharma. And they lead onwards. They lead onwards, but they always lead back to this very simple peace of knowing the way things are. The peace which is not dependent. And which isn't a condition, which isn't just like a conditioned situation, which isn't just kind of consequential. Just because because the situation is right, I'm happy and I'm peaceful. So on the retreat, everything belongs. You know, if you keep looking at it that way, your inspiration or your like, your dislike, it all belongs. And the beauty of this is you don't have to be a personality. You don't have to be charming. I have to be charming. I have to pump out the energy. Then on Monday I go boo. Ajahn Sumedho once, he had done a really big retreat at Amaravati. And I came into his kuti and he said, "Don't ask me to say anything wise. Don't ask me." The thing about a retreat, if you practice noble silence, you practice self-restraint, you practice contentment with little, you practice sati sampajanya, you practice sila, dana. And what does that do? What does that do? Well, one thing is you're not practicing ego, or less of it. You're not practicing personality. You're not practicing, not doing, being, whoever you are identified as. So all that identity with that begins to fall away. And the identity becomes more and more with mindfulness of the way things are. And that, as Ajahn Chah would say, that's your real home. Your real home isn't your thought processes, isn't your self-identity, isn't all of that. Those are just things which are conditioned through culture, through family, through gender, through different kinds of things. But your real home is something much, much more profound, much more profound. And these ways of reflection and contemplation are the ways of remembering that. You're remembering that again and again. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection then.